Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. In the studio with me, Stephanie Dombra. Stephanie, this is exciting, huh?
Yes, this is a wonderful show coming up.
All right, what are we talking about? We're going to be talking with Dr. Eric Mizell, who wrote a book about obsessions. Now, it's very interesting because, you know, there's a new series on television coming up about obsessions. Do you know about those, Eric?
I don't, actually.
There's a new reality series, which is all called Obsessions. And it's on one of the channels, and it's going to be a reality series about people with obsessions.
Well, I hope my book is scattered around the room.
I'm sure it would be. Well, let's talk a little about what you and Anne also co-authored the book with you as well, right?
That's right. She's my wife. She just retired from 35 years in a private high school working as a teacher and an administrator, so she got new time off, so she went to work on this book.
Great. So the name of the book is Brainstorm. Brainstorm, B-R-A-I-N-S-T-O-R-M. Eric, let's talk a little bit about it. What is Brainstorm about?
Well, the subtitle is Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions, and the book is really about the idea of productive obsessions. And as you probably know, most obsessions are thought of as negative. That happened about 120 years ago. One guy defined all obsessions as intrusive, unwanted thoughts, and we've been stuck with that way of looking at obsessions for the last 100 years. And, you know, writers and artists and scientists and business people have known for thousands of years that there are other kinds of obsessions, productive ones, positive ones. So our main goal was to return the word obsession to the positive side of the ledger and to remind people that there are definitely such things as productive obsessions and that we shouldn't spend all of our time thinking about only unproductive obsessions and OCD and that kind of stuff.
Well, okay, so could we do away with the obsessions? I mean, when people think of obsessions, they think about obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Correct.
Or they think about love obsessions. Is there such a thing as a positive love obsession?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm holding productive up. We're not talking about stalking someone. We don't think that's love. We don't think that kind of thing, that obsessiveness is really, you know, a love obsession. But what we're talking about here with respect to productive obsessions is just opening up your brain, releasing the grip of neurons from small thoughts to bigger thoughts, to having more neurons available for our bigger thoughts. So if the kind of thing we want to think about is, you know, how to help our child with an addiction, that's a love obsession of a certain sort. That's us deciding that we love our child enough that we're going to pay attention, we're going to use our brain to figure out what's useful there. So I think there are all kinds of senses of love obsession that absolutely fit into the model we're talking about. We're talking about is just using our brain more productively.
At the same time, Eric, though, you know, part of the reason I want to do something about my child is because I'm afraid that it will be out of my control. And fear very often motivates obsessions. And in fact, I would say most obsessions that are negative are based on fear.
That's a very good and big point. I would say as a category, all unproductive obsessions are fueled by anxiety. And I would say that as a category, productive obsessions are fueled by our meaning-making needs, our desire to make meaning, our desire to represent ourselves well and make ourselves proud. But just as you say, there's a mixture of things going on in most real-world obsessions. It's not pure meaning-making and not pure anxiety. To take a very simple example, if you start on your novel one day, you may be starting from a very pure, meaning-making, excited, passionate place. But by day two, you may be worried that you have no idea how to proceed with the novel, and then anxiety has crept in, and then another kind of dynamic is going on beneath the surface. So I entirely agree that there's a lot of fear, anxiety, doubt, worry, all of those kinds of words right behind most obsessions. And that is what distinguishes unproductive ones from productive ones.
Are they different chemically in the brain with the neurotransmitters? Would we have more different neurotransmitters working on the productive versus the unproductive ones?
We don't know that. The model that I'm using in the book is an interesting one called the neuronal gestalt model. And it's only one model of the brain. As you know, there are many competing models of the brain. what this model argues for is the idea that neurons form in what's called clouds, which just means that neurons gather to do a certain kind of work, and that when we are obsessing, what that means is more neurons have gathered and remain together for a longer duration. That's really what, on a physiological basis, an obsession is, lots of neurons gathering and staying together for a longer amount of time. But as to what's exactly going on a biological basis about hormones or neurotransmitters, I don't think we're close to really understanding that.
What about activation of different parts of the brain, like the anterior cingulate gyrate and so on and so forth?
Yeah, that's not something that I would know how to speak about.
Steph.
Well, I was just thinking about how you said that unproductive obsessions are fueled by fear and productive obsessions are fueled by meaning. And we as humans have this dilemma that we have this reptilian part of the brain, which
That's
is
right.
fear, and that guides or directs us with all our anxieties and fears. And then the meaningful part comes from this newer part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, where we're doing reasoning and thinking, and that the obsessing in that area is directing us towards a higher level of thinking and finding new ways to solve problems, whereas the fear is just instinctual.
That's exactly right, and that's why, of course, over the course of a given, even productive obsession, we're going to be going, so to speak, and this is metaphoric, not literally, so to speak, back and forth in the different parts of our brain, feeling passionate and excited and high one day, and the next day visiting the darker places or the more primitive places of our brain, wondering what our obsession is all about, wondering whether we should be pursuing it. So it is more like a roller coaster ride than a straight line kind of ride. Any kind of productive obsession, whether it's writing your novel or starting your business or even solving a problem, a personal problem, it's never a straight line journey. It's doubly not a straight line journey because as you think about things, your ideas change. So there's a natural dynamic there where on day one you thought you were writing a book about the best 20 retirement cities in America or something, and on day three you've decided you don't really want to write about Detroit or Los Angeles or something, and you're down to 18 cities. So there's this dynamic of your ideas changing as you actually think about them.
I can see you've written a few books, haven't you?
Yeah.
I can tell. You know, there are three rules of life. Here we go. Stephanie and I have been kind of focusing on these three. What are the three rules of life, Stephanie, right, of all living animals, all living things? Rule number one.
To find something to eat.
Find something to eat. Rule number two.
Pass on your genes.
And rule number three.
Not to be eaten.
Don't be eaten. Right? So we got three rules. This is for all plants, all animals, everything in nature, including our current brain. Find something to eat. That stabilizes us. That makes us okay.
That's right.
Now, reproduction. And this is where you're talking about positive obsession. Because by reproducing thought and reproducing it, not just replicating, we are creating. And so it seems that the creative part of us is an essential part of us.
Yeah, I would say it goes to the first of your principles almost equally well, the finding something to eat.
Find something to eat.
That's right, because as we know, we're not talking just about food to eat. We're talking about something to feel meaningful, something to interest us, something to engage us, something to occupy us. And we need to be eating better, so to speak, metaphorically, than we currently do. We have the language from the human potential movement. We still understand words like, phrases like human potential. And because we understand them, we also understand when we're disappointing ourselves, when we're not making use of our own potential. That doesn't feel good. So because we're noticing that about ourselves, we are continually looking out there, trying to figure out what would activate our potential, what would allow us to be the person we intend to be. And I think that's very similar to looking for food to eat.
You know, there's an interesting thing that people do. People who stay at home, they watch television very often, and they watch television that has zero meaning sometimes. It just keeps you where you are. And they watch other television that's interesting and stuff that stimulates your thought, and it's kind of a choice. People know what they call vegging out. Vegging out is when you don't grow, when you just let yourself remain constant, constant same thoughts. What's the difference between the obsessions that we don't want and the obsessions that we do want?
Well, we've said it one way already, and that is roughly that one is fueled by anxiety and worry, and the other is fueled by our meaning-making needs. So I think that may still be the most important distinction. But to say it differently, unproductive obsessions don't serve us, and productive obsessions do serve us. That's really the cutting edge between the two. And, you know, if you on a given day are trying to decide whether you want to embark on this process, then you know you're actually embarking on something. You're trying to do something that serves you, as opposed to being reactive and just reacting to some worry in your being.
Well, there must be some interesting examples of productive obsessions from history.
We decided to not use too many of the classical ones that people would know about, you know, the Beethovens and Einsteins, but those are certainly among, you know, the more interesting ones. Historically, we did a lot of looking at contemporary everyday ones. But to look at someone like a Beethoven, I think, is an interesting one, because we know that he had that special fantastic ability of hearing a musical thread, a folk tune when he was young, and somehow holding on to that somewhere in the brain, somewhere in the being, for decades until it became a symphony or a concerto or something. So that's a perfect example of a neuronal gestalt being held for a very long time. But then conversely, we also know that he was quite paranoid and he had tons of unproductive obsessions and was always worried about whether the maids were stealing the cutlery or the china. So both things were going on in him, and he clearly had no particular way to extinguish the unproductive ones. The productive ones came naturally, so to speak. The unproductive ones he couldn't handle.
I can just imagine, I'm just getting a picture of Beethoven sitting at a piano. Da-da-da-da. Nope, mm-hmm. That's not right. Da-da-da-dee. Nope, that's not right. Da-da-da-da. Nope, that's not right. And just keep working and working and working until it finally hits.
Yeah, and I think there's another important point that we can use Beethoven for as a kind of poster boy. And that's the idea of these obsessions coming with no guarantees, because everybody kind of wants to only do the work that works. They want to skip the work that doesn't work, which isn't the way the creative process or any process happens. So pundits who claim to know will say that Beethoven's first, third, fifth, seventh, and ninth symphonies are better than his second, fourth, sixth, and eighth. And, you know, I have no way of knowing if that's true or not, but what I know is you can't do nine without eight, you can't do eight without seven, you can't do seven without six. You can't skip the things that don't work. And I think that's what people who are unproductive are secretly wishing for. They want to skip the things that don't work.
Wow.
And the best way to do that is to not work. You've guaranteed that you're not going to do bad work by not working.
Boy, that's a very good definition of what I know to be the successful mind. See, in the successful mind, you're willing to stand pain. See, you don't say to yourself it has to be a pain-free experience.
That's right.
And what I know between adulthood and childhood is that children and adolescents always want to avoid pain. And adults say pain may come with the turf, but it's okay. It's only pain. So when
that's something that productive creative people somehow know in their bones. I don't think they're consciously saying, I don't mind spending 2 years on a novel that doesn't work. Nobody's really saying that consciously. What they're saying is, I'm going to show up. I'm going to show up, and if this one works, this one works, and if it doesn't, you know, I'm going for a body of work. And so I think that's a really interesting difference between the, as Ronk called the person, the artist manqué, the person who's fleeing from the experience of freedom, versus someone who's just going to sit there and do it, and if it doesn't work, they're just going to kind of, in a healthy narcissistic way, say, that's not about me, I don't care, that's about the thing, I'm just going to throw it out and do the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Steph.
Eric, can you elaborate on the show-up idea? Because I think a lot of listeners would love to know what happens when they show up and they're sitting there ready to go. What are some of the steps and things that they could do?
Yeah, let me put it in the following kind of context, which I think makes it an even a richer idea. I try to sell my creativity coaching clients and all my clients on the idea of a morning practice, that you don't need to obsess for 38 hours a day. In fact, you don't want to. You don't want to forget the names of your kids, and, you know, there are things that you want normal life to be normal life also. So the idea of bounding your productive obsession, knowing that you're only going to do it for a couple of hours, I think is important so that you don't get afraid that you're going to be losing the rest of life. So if you buy that idea that all you need to do is obsess for a couple of hours a day and you can get a lot done, then I try to sell clients on the idea that early morning is the very best time to do this before your day starts. This 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. time is really the best time to be working on your novel or your home business or whatever. And I think there are at least three important reasons for this. The first is the obvious one, that if you were to show up every morning, you would get work done over time. The second is that you can make use of your good sleep thinking, because the brain, as we know, not only dreams, it dreams in REM sleep and it thinks in non-REM sleep, doing plenty of thinking during the night too. But as soon as you turn to the day and make decisions about, you know, should I have a bagel or bran flakes, as soon as you start thinking about the day, whatever you've been thinking about starts to dissipate and vanish. So a second reason to have a morning practice is to make use of that good stuff you've just been thinking about before it wants to vanish. And then the third excellent reason for having a morning practice is that if you do have a morning practice, you'll have the experience of having made some meaning on that day already. And the rest of the day can be half meaningless, and you won't mind it.
What would be an example of a morning practice? You mean, let's say you're writing a book.
Correct.
Sit down and write your book.
Sit down and write your book. If you're trying to make a decision, this works for personal problems, too. If you're trying to make a decision, let's take a classic kind of sandwich generation decision. If you're in that sandwich generation and you have an ailing, aging father, and you're trying to figure out whether he can still stay at home, or whether there's a retirement home or a nursing home, all those kinds of decisions. If that's what you're working on, if that's your obsession of the moment, then you would spend that early morning hour maybe sending out emails to places at a further distance than you had been looking at previously to see if they have beds available. You'd actually be doing the work. You'd be either doing the thinking work, or you'd be doing whatever work follows from the thinking work. For an abstract, you know, for a theoretical mathematician, maybe there'd be nothing done on paper. Maybe it would just be pure thinking work. But for the rest of us, what follows from any idea that we're obsessing about is some actual work, whether it's writing the novel or starting the business or actually solving the personal problem. So that's what would go on in that hour, would be we'd be actually doing something.
A lot of people say get up and exercise. Get up and start your exercise right away. The first thing you should do is exercise your body and get that going first. Do you think that that helps, or it might interfere with the process?
Well, I'm a California guy, which means I deal with California people, which means that I'm dealing with people who have all kinds of things going on in that hour already, whether it's journaling or morning pages or yoga or Tai Chi or exercise. I ask them all to move that stuff to a different time of the day, not abandon it, but journal in the evening, do Tai Chi in the afternoon. That time is too valuable for your obsession to turn it over to exercise. Now, if you have a quick meditation practice, a 5-second meditation practice as opposed to a half-hour meditation practice, then by all means do your 5-second meditation and get on with your work. But too many people are using that time to give all of their good creative energy over to their journal as opposed to their novel. And especially people who do Julia Cameron's morning pages, and there are millions of them, who are doing morning pages as opposed to getting their actual creative work done. I think for all of those people, they have to, so to speak, bite the bullet and move those wonderful activities to a different part of the day.
Our guest is Eric Mizell, who with his wife Ann Mizell wrote the book Brainstorm, which is about harnessing the power of productive obsessions. And what Eric is making a case for is he says you've got two kinds. There are some obsessions that could hurt you, and there are obsessions that you need to live a better life. What are your top three tips for people who want to productively obsess?
Well, I think the first tip is to try to let go of thoughts that don't serve you. And as we were talking about before, every thought grabs neurons. That's what a thought is. It's 100 million or whatever number neurons gathering. So all the small thoughts we have, all the things on our perpetual to-do list, not only just worries, but just the natural things that we have to think about all day long are stealing neurons. And so the first tip is to learn more about that for yourself and to try to let go of thoughts that don't serve you, which means releasing the grip of neurons so that they're available, so that an obsession can arise.
Well, how do you do that? How do you do that if you're saying,
yeah.
Who did he spend the night with last night?
there are smart tactics. People just have to follow them. Let me address that.
Hitting yourself over the head with a frying pan?
No, let's say you want to let go of a thought that doesn't serve you. This is a three-step process that cognitive therapists teach, and I think it's a really smart one. And that is, first, you need to notice what you're saying to yourself, which is an act of courage, because, as you know, we are defensive, tricky creatures. We don't really even want to know what we're saying to ourselves. We don't want to notice that we're saying things like, there's too much competition, or I'm not talented, or any of that stuff. So we hear these things, but in a muted way. So step one is to notice what you're saying. Step two is to dispute those utterances which don't serve you. And that might sound like maybe what you're hearing is, I'm too tired, or I'm too busy. Those are the classic things that people are saying to themselves today to keep from working. I'm too tired and I'm too busy. So let's say you've found the courage to notice that you're saying, I'm too busy, way too much. Then the next step would be to dispute that and say, I am very busy, but I could spend 20 minutes on my novel. So first you hear what you're saying, second you dispute it, and then the third step is to substitute more affirmative language. It's to say, you know, I really want to write this novel, or I'm feeling great, or everything is good, or whatever. If you do this three-step thing of noticing and disputing and substituting, you actually will extinguish language that doesn't serve you over time. You won't have to arm wrestle this language from now till eternity. You'll just stop thinking them, because you will have kind of instantaneously, in a microsecond, done this whole thing of noticing what you were about to say, disputing it, substituting more affirmative language, and just not needing to say it anymore.
It's a good idea, if only that would work that simply. But most people, when they try, I think the real answer is the dispute. You know,
That's right.
Wake up in the morning and you say, I'm too tired to do this work. I just feel too tired. I'm knocked out. Now, what's the dispute?
First, you want to honor the truth of it, whatever percentage
yep,
is truth.
Yep, you are tired.
That's right, I am tired. And then it's the big but, the big B-U-T, but I really want to work on my novel, and therefore I'm going to muster some energy to work on it for 20 minutes, said not that cumbersomely.
So there's a voice talking back to you, acknowledging that you're tired, and saying, yes, we understand you're very tired, but can we pull out about 20 minutes here? Because the truth of it is, no matter how tired you are, if the house was on fire, you'd wake up and get out.
Not only that, you would get a surge of adrenaline. That's why you would be able to get out. And you can get that same surge of adrenaline if you can remember that you're in love with your work. So not only are you telling the truth that you could work for 20 minutes, but you're doing something different from just telling the truth. You're physiologically encouraging yourself to get an adrenaline burst to find enough energy to actually do the work.
Well, you're not in love with your work, but you're in love with yourself when
absolutely.
You are working.
Absolutely. You can say it either way, but it is. Pavarotti had a great quote, which I think is useful for people to hear, and when something like people say I'm disciplined, it's not discipline, it's devotion, and I think a lot of people get stuck on I'm not disciplined enough to do stuff and what have you, but if you remember that it is about love and its cognates, whether it's interest or curiosity or fascination or passion or love, any of those kinds of words, if we remember that that's what's fueling this decision to obsess about something, then it's also clear where the energy will come from, that it'll come from some burst of adrenaline.
You know, Eric, I work with clients as well, and a lot of times people actually have this whole theory that they're trying to sabotage themselves and their success. And I wonder if you've thought about why does the negative thoughts come in? You know, because a lot of people will assume that they're actually trying to sabotage themselves and not want to be successful, and they go down that whole path of
sure.
beating themselves up. Have you given it the thought?
Yeah, I think there are a slew of reasons. I think, you know, in psychological language, it's overdetermined, that there isn't just one reason, but there are plenty of them, and that's why it can feel so intractable. The first is that creative work, I think as you said before, creative work is harder than watching TV. It's just harder. And people, you know, have a lot of smiley-faced ideas about the creative process. They want to be inspired. They want it to be easy. They're told in many books that you just act like a channel and it comes through you and all of that. But in fact, it's really hard to write a symphony or a novel or start a business or do anything. It's hard. So they're not quite acknowledging how hard it's going to be, but they know in a corner of consciousness that they don't want that hardness. They'd rather do something easy today than that hard thing. So they create a thought that allows them to not have to do that work today. I think that's an important part of it, is that the work we're talking about is harder than turning on the TV.
I like that thought. We create a thought that bails us out of our own motivation.
That's right.
We create a thought like, oh, you're too tired. Oh, it doesn't have any meaning. Oh, you can't afford it. Oh, you need more sleep. Oh,
and there's too much competition, and I'm too old, and I have no, and it doesn't matter, and I could make this list go on and on, but these are the things that people are actually saying to themselves, including those existential ones around mattering. I don't matter, this doesn't matter, who needs another painting, blah, blah, blah. All of that, all the kinds of utterances that lead almost inexorably to existential depression, where you end up feeling like you don't matter.
Very good. Okay, now you're saying there are three top tips for people who want to protect. The second tip is how you manage your
Yeah, the second tip would be to choose something we're thinking about, which is harder than it sounds because we're so busy typically getting things done off our perpetual to-do list that we only have a superficial understanding of what actually interests us. And often what really interests us are those same things that interested us when we were 5, 6, 7, and 8, whether it was books or music or art or nature or science, whatever. But they've gotten pushed aside over the years, over the decades, as we've attended to the realities of life. So the second step is to say it in a mechanical way, generate a list of things that interest you, and look at that list and see what on that list wants to actually rise to the level of a productive obsession. Then you choose that and commit to that for a while and see if it really does want to rise to that level. So to say that all more simply, you want to choose something worth thinking about.
And the third tip?
Once you've done that, then you want to make time and space for this obsession. The time we've talked about already, I think, the idea of a morning meaning practice, getting it on your schedule. You know, as young people, we hate words like schedule and plan and regularity and routine. They just seem so boring to us. They remind us of school. But as we get older, we realize that we're only going to be doing things on our to-do list if we don't schedule other things, that we need to really have a regular way of getting this obsession on our plate. So there's the time part of scheduling it, and then there's the space part. You need fewer distractions to do this kind of thinking. You need a room with a door that closes. You don't want people wandering in and out, if you can help that, as you're trying to think. So the simple third step would be to make space and time.
That's great. This is Dr. Eric Maisel. Fascinating work, harnessing the power of the productive obsession. Like he said, you know, years ago we looked at the word obsession and we said, it's an intrusive thought that you can't get out of your mind. Well, Eric is asking an important question. Maybe it's intrusive for a good reason. Maybe you want it to intrude. Maybe it's part of your creativity in your life. Maybe it's the very food that you need to keep yourself alive. Maybe it's a path out of depression, as opposed to what we see as obsession is the path into depression. In fact, the very same medication that is used to cure depression is often used to cure obsessive compulsive disorders. They use the same antidepressants to say, let's make your mind not be obsessive, and we will get you undepressed. Well, Eric Maisel is saying a little different than that. He's saying, no, we've got a different ways to use our obsessive mind. We could take our obsessive mind and we could rechannel it, rework it in such a way that it doesn't hurt us and it doesn't depress us, but in fact enlivens us. So this is very fascinating stuff, and we have a lot more to cover with you, my friends. Brainstorm, harnessing the power of productive obsessions. We are going to be taking a short break. And after we take our short break, when we come back, we will continue with more of this. This is Armand DeMille with you with Stephanie Dombra, Dr. Eric Maisel on WBAI 99.5 FM. We'll be right back. With you with the positive mind. Dr. Eric Mizell, talking about harnessing the power of productive obsessions, in case you just tuned in. Now, Eric, let's continue. Give us some more thoughts about this.
Well, to continue then, we were talking about the three top tips. Let me add a tip or two to those top three tips. I think one is, if you're trying to do this work, if you're trying to obsess something into existence and you're a person in real life, then you need to get agreements with the people around you that you have permission to spend time thinking about things. And that may sound like, who needs to do that? Doesn't everybody have that permission? But in fact, with the clients I work with, they often have to get agreements with their wife or their husband or their kids that for a certain hour or two, they're actually not available, that their door stays closed, and unless it's a true emergency, it's not a, you know, we've run out of peanut butter kind of emergency, but a true emergency, that they're not available. And a lot of people actually have trouble orchestrating those agreements with the people in their lives. Their lives are more permeable than they ought to be, and people are allowed in and out more easily than they ought to be. So another step is having this strength, this power, to say to yourself first and then to other people, I deserve this hour, whether it's 5 in the morning or 7 in the evening, I deserve this hour to really bite into something, to really be passionate about something, to really enjoy something.
Well, you know, it may be a little more than I deserve. It may mean I need this hour for us. I need to keep myself feeling beautiful and productive to be a good part of this family. Maybe it takes negotiating with the family as well. Because when the family's used to you giving yourself away, let's say you're the average caretaker, and you're so used to taking care of everybody every morning, and then you suddenly want to turn to them and say, I'm not going to do that in the morning, they're going to rebel. Unless you have a way of negotiating with them and saying to them, I'm going to take this time for myself, but I'm going to substitute for that a little time in the afternoon. Sometimes it takes more than just standing up and being adamant. Sometimes it takes a negotiation, I think.
That's right, and it also takes a little self-understanding about not to feel guilty about this. It's surprising that anybody would feel guilty about reclaiming an hour and doing something which, as you say, is not good just for herself but for her whole family, and yet there's so much guilt built into our systems that it's very hard for a person in that position often to not feel guilty about saying something strong about that 1 hour that she wants back. So there's the getting over the guilt part, too.
Eric, in your work, what other books did you write? What else did you do?
Well, you're asking for a long list. I've done probably 30 books, but let me hit some highlight ones.
Yes.
Because I'm really trying to investigate the realities of the creative person's life, not airy-fairy stuff, but realities. So I've done a book on creativity and depression called The Van Gogh Blues, and a book on creativity and anxiety called Fearless Creating, and a book on creativity and addictions called Creative Recovery. So I think you can see that I've tried to take out big thematic ideas like depression and anxiety and addiction and what have you, and focus whole books around them.
Could you give us a little help on the creativity and addiction? I'd like to know more about that.
Well, of course, there's a ton to say there, but let me just try to hit a couple of highlights. One, I think, is that creative and performing artists, or all creative people, maybe are a little more susceptible to addictions than the next person for a couple of reasons. One is, I think we have bigger appetites for whatever reason. I don't think we could possibly know why we get born with bigger appetites, but some people do seem to have bigger appetites than other people, appetites for life, appetites that look like curiosity, but then appetites like Orson Welles for eating 1,000 peanuts or 1,000,000 peanuts. So we get born with appetites that need regulating and that lead us to danger points. Second point is, and again, we don't know why this is, but I do think that some infants come out of the womb already stubborn, already stubbornly decisive about being an individual, that they already look around themselves at age 5 or 6 or 7 and 8, and they're going, why are adults doing these things? None of this interests me. They're already unconventional, idiosyncratic, and most importantly, they understand that they're going to have to make their own meaning because they're just not interested in received wisdom. The stuff they see around them that's trying to be fed to them doesn't interest them. So if you take just these two main ideas, that a creative performing individual might have a bigger appetite and more of a need to make personal meaning, and therefore more likely to get frustrated when those meaning-making needs are thwarted by reality, then you have two important risk elements for the creative person, the appetite risk and the meaning-making risk. Very so good. I'm going off, you know, this is...
No, good, good. Stick with it, because I love, you know, every now and then there's a chance to think with something on the air, and to me this is creative thinking with you, and I appreciate your thinking. So the first is, let's go to the appetite.
Yep.
So one of the things we've discovered lately is that there are certain appetite levels in the brain. There's a shut-off valve that says you don't need any more peanuts, you know, and for some people have it and other people don't. And you're saying that creative people very often, they have excessive appetites with very little control over the appetites.
That's right. And I think that they want, to use poor metaphor here, that they actually want to keep that control, they want to keep that switch flipped up, so to speak, because it's the same appetite that allows them to find the energy to work on their novel for 3 years that's forcing them in a negative way to eat all those peanuts. So there's a way in which they don't want to damp down their enthusiasm and their appetite because it's also serving their creative needs. And you can see this becomes a very complicated dynamic in your own body when you're trying to, on the one side, reduce your enthusiasm for peanuts and on the other side, keep up your enthusiasm for singing opera. It's a very tricky dynamic in the body.
Oh, very tricky as well, because that shut-off valve, you're right. That shut-off valve, even though it may be very limber, and it may be that we like to keep it open, we believe, and many people say this who are creative, they say, if you take away my depression, will I lose my creativity?
Exactly.
And
that kind of thing.
It's almost like
if you force me to shut this thing off, I don't know what's going to happen, but I doubt that I'm really going to be happy.
Now, the truth of it is, when we do get people shutting off one part of their impulse-driven self, it does not interfere with their creativity. But it's interesting that the brain connects the two.
That's right. And to go along with that, that's why probably the most challenging period of time in this process of recovery for a creative person is early recovery, because there's a special dynamic that goes on there where you actually have to reduce your expectations as to what creating you get to do in that first year of recovery, because you are trying to keep that switch off, so to speak. You're trying to not have an appetite, so to speak. And it's actually a little dangerous to turn that switch on for the sake of your new novel or your new symphony. So it can be kind of a dull year as you're working your recovery program and not getting to create as much as you like, but actually it would be too risky to create as much as you like. So again, you can see how much dynamism there is in a recovery program for creative people.
Well, and you have this fascinating other part, you know, because very often we see addiction related to psychopathy, you know, and we see the person who has got this kind of temperament that says, I don't care, I'm going to do it my way.
Yep.
And that goes along with what you're talking about, which is the defiance that seems to come along with the creative personality. Now we have big appetites and a defiant self. It's like
that's
an
right.
alligator
who wants to sing. That's right. I use a slightly different language of oppositional, but it's the same idea.
Oppositional is perfect, yes.
That's right. It's the person, I think, fighting off from the first grade on, from kindergarten on, being oppositional because that person just doesn't want to accept received wisdom. It's like if you tell me that 2 + 2 = 4, maybe I'll believe you, but I actually want to figure it out for myself, and it becomes 4, I'm still not going to give you credit for it. It's still going to be me figuring it out again by trial and error experimentation. So that whole energy, that oppositional energy that starts in school, that makes so many kids look ADD or look something or another, but it's just them not wanting to be there and wanting to live life on their own, all of that just continues on and becomes a personality thread that makes it, once they do get addicted, once they find their drug of choice, so to speak, it makes it that much difficult for them to stop because now they have this oppositional thread to deal with also.
You know, I remember if you ever go to a wedding where people get drunk and then there's a bunch of guys all at once singing the song My Way because they all want to join in when they get to that part because secretly everybody believes that they have defied the rest of the world.
That's right.
And they, my defiance, I am proud of my defiance. We did it my way, you know. And the real question about it would be, you know, maybe it would have been nice if it were our way.
And that's right. And I think a word like narcissism doesn't make a lot of sense unless you stick the right adjective in front of it. Because we know there's healthy narcissism. It's what we want. Developmental psychologists will talk about healthy narcissism and the kind of healthy narcissism you want kids to be acquiring as they grow up. And then there's unhealthy narcissism, that grandiosity, arrogance, and what have you, that we see in so many people who are successful. So it's walking that line between the healthy narcissism of correctly wanting to do things your own way and then sliding over into other place of unhealthy narcissism where you're a pain in the neck to other people.
Well, when you're on the unhealthy narcissistic way, you're very vulnerable to having your life shattered. You know, it's a very vulnerable way to be because a narcissistic wound could cripple you. If your image of yourself suddenly gets shattered and you're in an unhealthy narcissism, it could wipe you out completely.
That's right. And, you know, among my 30 books, and that's the and I entirely agree, that's why I did a book called Toxic Criticism, because for my people, for my the creative and performing artists I work with, issues of criticism and rejection are so important, because what happens is exactly what you said. It's not just that you got a rejection letter. That's not it. It's that it got under your skin in some deep place, wounded you, causes you to now give up this thing that you know you love, and suddenly you're bereft of meaning. All that happened was a letter came to your into your mailbox, or nowadays an email arrived in your inbox. Somebody didn't like something. And from that marginal, small, minimal interaction, your whole life changes and meaning dissipates just on the spot.
Toxic, what do you call it?
Toxic criticism.
And so what do you recommend for the artists among us who can be very sensitive to that?
Well, again, you know, to condense a book in a sentence is a little hard, but let me give you one headline, and that is the idea of temporizing with yourself. It's one thing to get criticized and not respond to the other person right off the bat. I think we all know that's sensible, that it's sensible to take a little time before we react to the person out there because it might be important for us to frame our reaction carefully. But equally important is to temporize with ourselves, to find some nice long pause between receiving the information as criticism and actually taking it as criticism. To do a better job of, as the Buddha said, getting a grip of our own mind, to have the ability to not take that criticism as criticism in that split second, and to have more time available to correctly appraise the situation. On a practical level, a tremendously smart thing to do is, as you know, criticism builds up bile in our system. It's just something that we need to get out of our system or else it's going to eat away at us. So I suggest that people write a Dear Critic letter, which they then, of course, don't mail, but in which they use every expletive deleted word that they've ever heard of and, so to speak, get their revenge on the critic and get even, get the bile out of their system so that they feel like they have some control over the system, that at least they have this power. What's interesting about this Dear Critic letter mechanism is that what people often find that themselves doing is that the first paragraph is all about venting and getting this bile out, but by the third paragraph, they're having an actual conversation with the critic in which they, the artist, are finding their own part in the criticism. They're acknowledging the part they didn't do well in the novel.
Could you take me through a step of that? Give me a good example of that. Let's say a person is an actor or applies for an acting job and gets a letter that says, sorry, we don't think you should be on stage at all.
Sure. You first make the clear decision that you're not going to react dramatic. You're not going to go to some catastrophizing dramatic place with this thing. That's an attitudinal choice or an intellectual choice on your part that you've learned. It's a habit where you learn not to react in that split second to that letter over dramatically.
Well, let's just keep that word catastrophizing, and let's talk about it because people could use it. To catastrophize, which is to take any one incident and to take it out of proportion where it's your entire life is at stake. It's like the end of the world.
That's right. And as you know, and listeners may not know this, but I'm sure you do, another way to say it is to disidentify from the thing. disidentification is very much like detachment in Buddhism. It's an idea from a psychologist named Asagioli, and it's the centerpiece of a brand of psychotherapy called psychosynthesis. That's all a long-winded way of saying the same sort of idea where you say to yourself, I am bigger than this moment. I am bigger than this thing the person just sent to me. I am not my performance that she saw. I'm not not the book I wrote. I am bigger, richer, deeper, more important to me than this thing. So it's a way of being phlegmatic and philosophical in the moment. It's attitudinal stuff that you learn for yourself, how to be more phlegmatic and philosophical in the moment. So let's say you've managed that. Then you look at the thing, and I think I've lost your example, but let's say it was a letter saying
an actor on stage who's getting a letter saying that you shouldn't even be on stage at all.
Shouldn't even be on the stage. Okay. Then you turn to this second technique of writing a dear critic letter, and so you write back, Dear Mr. Jones, this was the expletive deleted, stupidest thing I've ever received in the mail. You can't teach for a darn, and blah, blah, blah. So first you vent. But as you vent, you hold the question in the back of your mind, is what Mr. Jones said partially true? Is it actually the case that I don't project very well on stage? Is it actually the case that I'm much more anxious at auditions than I need to be and that I'm blowing auditions because of my performance anxiety, etc.? So you're having a very interesting conversation. As you're venting in paragraph one, you're also having an honorable discussion with yourself about the truth of the matter, and you're honorably looking at your part in the puzzle, the places maybe where you need to grow and stretch and get better. And so your third paragraph might sound like, you know, even though I do think you're an expletive deleted, I do agree that perhaps I need addiction class and I need my sword fighting skills to be better. I think I do agree that I need to do X, Y, and Z. So by the end of this Dear Critic letter, which as I say, you burn, you never want to send these things in the real world. At the end of this, you've both managed to get the bile out. You've vented your system, but you've also learned a thing or two for yourself about what you need to do next.
So there are ways that people could deal with criticism that makes it be a learning process. And I think what's really important when you talk about catastrophizing, sometimes when people develop an obsession that's based on some unfelt need, like, for example, I want to be admired and loved by everybody, therefore I'm going to become a dancer. And you dance for the admiration and love, but there's this motivation that's all the way behind there, deep in your psyche. So when someone comes along and says, I will not take you as a dancer, they're in effect saying, I won't give you the love you need. I think there's some psychological awareness that would help us to understand if we're obsessed about something, that there are unfelt needs in there. There's more than just needing to have meaning. What do you think about the psychological insight that goes along with it?
I absolutely agree. And I think what we're all talking about is the idea of increased self-awareness. We because we are defensive, tricky creatures, because we have all kinds of motivations from different parts of our brain, because so much is going on, our number one job is to remain aware. And part of remaining aware is what I just was saying about temporizing. It's when things happen to have some spaciousness there so that you can do in a nanosecond this work we're talking about of not just reacting, not just being a reactive person in the world and reacting from our normal way, whether it's to apologize or to be oppositional, whatever our normal way is, rather than just reacting that way, to have enough spaciousness to have a few seconds available to not react just in a knee-jerk way, but to understand some of the things that both of us are talking about, whether it's meaning-making needs or deep-seated unmet needs, whatever it is, to be better in touch with that. The more we can do this work that you're talking about and I'm talking about, the better that these events don't strike us as blows.
When you bring back the works of Asagioli, which I haven't heard in a long time, is that an early field of study for you?
I'm sorry, I missed the word.
Psychosynthesis. Was
oh, yes. No, it is something I know something about. I've been in many kind of new agey counseling centers in my life, And we've gotten trainings on almost everything under the sun, and I've had some trainings in psychosynthesis and the idea of disidentifying, which, as I say, will be more familiar to people as probably the idea of detachment in Buddhism.
And what about the Buddhist way, since you've moved in that direction as well? Is there any of your
tricky
Buddhist teaching?
I do think that's tricky because obviously Buddhism does a lovely job of explaining how to detach and giving rationales for detaching. It doesn't really do as good a job in talking about attaching, and we need to attach also. We are who we are. We are Western, ego-driven, et cetera, people. And when you are biting into something, when you want to start your novel, you want your ambitions and your dreams and all of that to be a reality. You want to actually attach. And it's hard for someone who's doing a lot of practicing around detachment to do a good job of attaching. And so I think both to switch to another brand of philosophy, if you're a Taoist and you know your yin-yang, what you know is that yin-yang is not about being feminine or masculine. It's about having all of those qualities available to you and then choosing on the spot which of those qualities to manifest. I think detachment and attachment are two, so to speak, polar opposite qualities. We want to know how to use both of them. We want to know to attach when we're starting in a project and then detach when we're putting it in the marketplace. So I think Buddhism is strong in one of those two areas and weak in the other.
Yeah, but it's very difficult because, you know, the very energy that it requires to become a productive obsessionist, you know what I mean? If you want to...
That's right.
You need energy, and energy going out is kind of the opposite of what the Buddha is about, although it is believed. You know, in a Buddhist way, you do believe that there's an energy circle of sort, but you would never have a Buddhist radio station. Because it would be very quiet.
It would be very quiet.
And nobody would be paying attention because it doesn't feed the energy. But
that's,
you know,
right, and all the art would blow away. It would all be sand art, and it would be lovely and beautiful in the moment, and it would all blow away. And we're not really blow-away kind of people. We actually want our things to last and to make a difference and all of that, so I agree.
So for the people who want their things to last, the study of this this being productive, obsessional productive, is kind of an interesting thing. The name of the author, Eric Mizell, who with his wife Anne Mizell wrote the book Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. But on top of that, Eric, you seem to be a good thinker. I mean, you've got a mind that keeps fetching out there, and I kind of like the fact that you're someone who could think. When it comes to psychological insight, just one last question.
Sure.
Is there any point at which you stop trying to learn about your own neurotic attachments?
I don't think so. I think when you're young, whatever young means, you think it gets easier or different somewhere along the line. But for me, to use my language, I think our meaning-making needs never go away. If we're 62 or 94, we still need to know what today is about with respect to meaning. And in order to do a good job of making meaning, we need to know what's making us tick. So that's probably a long-winded way to say I entirely agree. I don't think there is any moment in time where we ought to be at a stopping point with respect to understanding ourselves.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us. Eric, thanks again. We may speak again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to be going, my friends, and we'll be back with you soon. If you want to hear this program, of course, you can go to WBAI.org or to thepositivemind.com. Back with you soon.
John Duval's Paleozoic twilight from the Paleozoic era. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, 83 degrees at 156. You can connect with this radio station online at WBAI.org as always. And remember to contribute to keep this listener-supported, commercially free radio station on the air.
Hi, this is Delphine Blue inviting you to join me every Tuesday night here on WBAI at 99.5 FM for Shocking Blue from 9 until 11 p.m. That's every Tuesday night right here on member-supported WBAI New York at 99.5 FM.
Hi, my name is Anila Mohammed. When I'm in New Jersey, I always have my radio tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI. And when I'm back home in Pakistan, I listen on the web at WBAI.org. Assalamu alaikum. Mera naam Anila Mohammed hai. Jab main New Jersey mein hoti hoon, to main hamesha 99.5 FM, WBAI ko sunti hoon. Aur jab apne mulk Pakistan mein hoti hoon, तो हमेशा WBAI की वेबसाइट WBAI.org को सुनती हूँ। अस्सलामु अलैकुम, मेरा नाम अनीला मोहम्मद है। तो जिदो मैं न्यू जर्सी होनी हूँ, तो हमेशा 99.5 FM WBAI नु सुननी हूँ। तो जिदो अपने मुल्क पाकिस्तान होनी हूँ, तो हमेशा WBAI दी वेबसाइट WBAI.org